You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
With unemployment stalled around 8% and 2 million students about to graduate, more Americans than ever will be looking for a job in the coming months. And despite what you might think, where you live will have more of an effect on your employment opportunities than what industry you work in. In his book, The New Geography of Jobs, published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, UC Berkeley economist Enrico Moretti redraws the map and joins us here today to talk about it all. Welcome to our show.
Thank you for having me.
You say the current economy has divided the country into three geographical categories according to their industry. What are they?
Well, if you look at the economic map of America today, you see three increasingly different countries. On one end, you have cities like San Francisco, Austin, or Seattle with a very strong innovation-driven economy and a labor force that is one of the most creative and best paid on the globe. At the other extreme, you see the former manufacturing capitals. You see Cleveland, Flint, Detroit, with shrinking population and falling wages. And in the middle, there is the rest of the country, which appears undecided on which direction to take. In the 1980s, the three Americas were different, but not all that different. But they've been growing apart ever since. And this divergence reflects deep-seated economic forces.
Well, there was always a feeling that New York was different than the rest of the country. And companies that wanted to have skilled workers were willing to pay a little extra to be here. That's all changed. When you mention the tech cities, you didn't mention New York, although there's a lot of talk about New York becoming a tech city and having a tech boom.
New York is becoming a tech city. Historically, New York didn't have a lot of innovation because real estate is very expensive here, and so lab space is scarce. So, for example, if you look at patents per capita, New York is not among the top cities. But over the past 10, 15 years, there has been an increased agglomeration of software, internet, digital entertainment jobs in the city that is mostly driven by the presence of young, well-educated workers who want to be here.
And now there's talk about creating a new school that will add to that. The city launched a map yesterday at mapdini.com showing that 340 New York City tech companies are hiring for more than 1,000 jobs. Most of the openings are for engineers. But on the station this morning, Stan Alcorn, one of our reporters, went to a local job fair, and he found that startups are finding it difficult to find suitable employees. Part of the problem is that the most capable people are interested in creating their own startups.
Sure, and this is one of the key elements of a successful cluster. Once you attract an employer in iTech, you also attract many more employers, and some of those new firms come from employees who want to start their own startup. And this is a case where success generates even more success for a community.
Well, there were more than 1,000 web-based tech startups in the city, according to a report from earlier this month, but almost half of them, 486, received major funding in the last 5 years from angel, seed, or venture capital funding. So an area can actually make itself into a tech center?
Well, it's hard. New York is a special case because it always had a very skilled labor force and always had a lot of innovation. It wasn't in high tech. It was in finance, in marketing, in other parts of its local economy. But, you know, New York doesn't have an economy like Flint or Detroit. It has always been a magnet for highly skilled workers.
On the other hand, it doesn't have an economy like the Silicon Valley or the Boston area.
Not yet. But my impression
You're seeing that happening in the future?
Well, my prediction is that the importance of finance will tend to decline in the future decades, and the importance of iTech will tend to increase for the labor force of New York.
You say that we're too dependent on finance, the finance industry in the city.
Well, I'm saying that probably with everything that has been happening to the sector, the number of jobs and the magnitude of the salaries can't keep growing at the same rate. And so looking forward, probably iTech is a good part of the economy to have.
Well, right now in the city, unemployment is almost 2 points higher than the national average. Is that because of the problems in the financial industry?
In part, but you know, cities like New York, with a very well-educated labor force and a very creative labor force, are bound to rebound fast and to do much better in the coming 3 to 5 years.
But we rely so much on our tax base relies so much on the financial industry, and when things are down, as they are right now, and they're probably going to get a little worse as a result of this J.P. Morgan Chase problem, then the city's going to suffer. On the other hand, we talk about the great successes of the area that you're in, and yet California is suffering from an incredible shortfall.
California is suffering, but if you look at where California is suffering, it's not Silicon Valley. Silicon Valley and San Francisco are now among the most dynamic labor market in the nation. California is suffering because there are vast part of the state, the southern part and the central valley, that don't have a very innovative and highly educated labor force. And they're suffering also because a lot of the construction jobs that were fueling that economy have disappeared.
We also read that companies like Apple are shipping all major parts of their business out of the state so they don't have to pay taxes.
Yeah, high taxes in California are obviously part of the problem. But overall, I'm bullish on the California economy. I think the best year of the states are ahead of us.
My guest is Enrico Moretti. He's a professor of economics at the University of California, Berkeley. His latest book, The New Geography of Jobs, it's published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. Well, let's look at China for a moment. There's this city, Shenzhen, one of the fastest growing cities with one of the world's busiest ports. Container ships leave there at a rate of 1 per second. And it actually only represents still less than a half of China's total exports. But 30 years ago, this was just a sleepy village. So China decided to make it into a major economic center?
It did. And what's interesting is that the growth of Shenzhen perfectly paralleled the decline of our own manufacturing centers. In the 70s, the China leadership single out Shenzhen as their first special economic zone. And over time, thousands and then hundreds of thousands of American manufacturing jobs in Cleveland, Flint, and Detroit started moving there. Shenzhen is particularly interesting because it's where the iPhone is assembled. And I think it highlights one of the features of the future of and the challenges of the American labor force.
Well, could an American state or the federal government decide to come up with an American equivalent of Shenzhen?
Would it
work?
I don't think so.
Well, first of all, you'd have to attract 10 million people to it, and then you'd have to pay them salaries that are below the average American wage.
Yes. There is a lot of talk these days about the renaissance of the manufacturing sector in the U.S., but I'm skeptical. The last 2 years have been good, because the manufacturing sector in the U.S. has added a few hundred thousand jobs, and that's great news. But the reality is that the manufacturing employment in the U.S. has been declining for the past 30 years, and the same forces that have pushed jobs from Detroit to Shenzhen are likely to continue. In fact, they're likely to accelerate. So if I were a state or a city, I wouldn't put all my eggs in the manufacturing basket.
But you also say America manufactures more than Korea, Japan, and Germany.
It does, and it manufactures more than twice as much as the U.S. 30 years ago, but it uses fewer and fewer workers. That's one of the great paradoxes of our economy. American manufacturing companies are leaders, global leaders, but thanks to robots and automation, they need fewer and fewer workers. For example, GM, the number of workers that GM uses per car produced has dropped 80 to 90% in the past 50 years. Now, that's just the nature of automation and technological progress. There is little we can do or should do about that, because that means that's one way in which our economy is always propelled forward.
And we've also relied on worker productivity. how many times have people told me that they fired somebody in their office and two people are now expected to do the job of three? I understand why that would be a good idea from the employer's point of view, but in the old days, a lot more people had jobs.
It is true, but in the even older days, it was agriculture with a lot of jobs, and then the tractor and fertilizer came along and made an increased productivity of agricultural workers, and then and now basically one in 100 American workers work in agriculture. So we can't, and I don't think we should, try to stop this progress. This is one of the key ways in which earnings and wages of American workers increase. It's higher productivity.
Now, you mentioned that the iPhone is manufactured in Shenzhen, but whenever people complain about that, we hear about how great American innovation and creativity remains. Is that true?
It is true. I think there's a lot of talk about outsourcing and delocalization. But the reality is that the innovation sector in the U.S., it's healthy, has become healthier over time. For example, jobs in many parts of iTech have grown tremendously. Jobs in the internet sector have grown 200 times faster than the rest of the labor force.
But you also say creativity is scarce now.
Creativity is probably the scarcest factor of all. Good ideas and innovative ideas have tremendous economic returns, and that's where I think we should focus as a nation.
Do foreign consumers think of Apple products as being American-made?
Well, if you have an iPhone and you flip it around, on the back it's written, "Designed in California, made in China." I do think that American consumers think of the iPhone as a Californian or an American product. This is one of the most iconic products that we are exporting.
We are seeing some companies like GE bringing jobs back to America, but it's not enough to fill the gap? What kinds of jobs are they bringing back?
They're bringing back some jobs.
What's being called insourcing?
Yes. It's the opposite of outsourcing, where American companies are bringing back jobs that used to be in Mexico or in Vietnam or in China. And we've seen some of that, but I'm skeptical that this is the reversal of the trend. We have been losing on average of 370,000 blue-collar jobs per year for the past 30 years. So the fact that the last year was a little bit better than usual, it doesn't change a pretty scary and disappointing downward trend for this sector. Now, one exception is it's advanced manufacturing, which is the most innovative part of that sector. That's where a lot of U.S. R&D is concentrated, and that's where the little job growth that the sector has seen is concentrated. But we should be clear about the type of job that we are creating there. You know, U.S. manufacturing has lost, as I said, 370,000 blue-collar positions per year for the past 30 years, but it has doubled the number of engineers employed in manufacturing. So, you know, when we talk about advanced manufacturing, we're not talking about a job for the average high school graduate. We're talking about a job for somebody with a college degree or a master's degree.
And we also hear complaints from manufacturers that they can't find enough people who have the skills. In the past, you could graduate without a high school diploma and get a job in manufacturing. That would really be impossible today.
I think it would be increasingly difficult. Yeah, that's right.
My guest is Professor Enrico Moretti, a professor of economics at the University of California, Berkeley. His book, The New Geography of Jobs, is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, and we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Enrico Moretti, a professor of economics at the University of California, Berkeley. He has his research has been supported by the National Science Foundation and the National Institutes of Health. And he has been featured in New York Times, The Wall Street Journal, Slate, other publications. His book, The New Geography of Jobs, it is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. And we've been getting questions from our listeners. Tom from Seabrook, New Jersey asks, what about what Steve Jobs said about tech jobs never coming back to this country? Americans won't accept such low wages and poor working conditions.
Well, that's a good question and a key question. The probably not every American can work for Apple or Google or the next biotech company. But the rise of jobs in the innovation sector matters to all of us, whether we work in iTech or we don't. And the reason is that, you know, most people in America today work in local services. And every time a community is able to attract an iTech employer, it gains more than just the jobs directly created by that employer. It gains many more jobs in the local service sector. And I'm talking about jobs that go from real estate agents and taxi drivers and waiters to doctors and lawyers and nurses.
Five jobs, you say, for every one job in the tech sector.
Yes. This is some of the research that I've done. It quantifies this effect. It's a remarkably large effect. For each job in the tech sector, five.
You mentioned Twitter, in fact, in the book.
Yeah. So every time Twitter hires a software engineer in downtown San Francisco, there are five jobs for people outside Twitter, some of which, about three of which, go to workers with a high school degree, the baristas and the taxi drivers and so on, and two goes to workers with a college degree, the doctors and lawyers. Going back to the original question, take Apple. Apple has 13,000 employees in Cupertino, but it supports 70,000 jobs outside iTech in the local economy. So remarkably, the biggest impact that Apple has in the region employment is not in iTech, is outside iTech.
But we've seen that in the past with company towns, and then U.S. Steel picks up and leaves, and or GM leaves Flint, Michigan, and suddenly all those five people for every worker in the plant are out of work. The restaurants close, banks close.
There's
no construction.
There is that risk. The biggest difference between innovation and manufacturing in that respect is that the multiplier effect is much larger in the innovation sector. It's about three times larger for iTech companies than manufacturing companies. So a community that attracts a factory certainly has an increase in jobs outside manufacturing. But the same community, if they can attract an iTech company, they're going to have three times more jobs, and those jobs tend to be better paid. I think it highlights a very surprising policy implication. If a community is trying to generate jobs for the least fortunate of its citizens, those who don't have a lot of education, probably one of the best way to do it today is to attract an iTech employer who hires a lot of skilled and highly educated workers.
Well, we're hearing about how increasingly important it is to have a college degree. But at the same time, the news is filled with stories about people who are unable to repay their student loans. So are we creating policies that are working against our best interests?
No. A college degree pays and pays more and more. It used to be that a college degree paid about 30% more than an high school degree in terms of higher wages over the life cycle. And now it's more than double that. So over a life cycle, a college graduate typically earns something in the order of $1 million. An high school graduate earns about half of that amount, and the gap keeps growing. People are struggling with college loans, but on average, the average experience of a college graduate today is much better than the average experience of an high school graduate today.
Some pundits, including Thomas Friedman, foresee a world where technology will allow commerce to disperse away from high-cost hubs like Silicon Valley. So why are we seeing the opposite increased agglomeration of businesses?
This is one of the most interesting paradoxes of our world today. We live in an increasingly globalized economy where it's easy to communicate by email, by cell phone. Plane flights are cheap. In theory, location shouldn't matter.
We can work from home instead of going to an office.
In theory, we could work from home. We could work with distant colleagues. We could communicate by email and cell phones. But the reality is that face-to-face interaction is more important than ever. geographical proximity is more important than ever, and location is more important than ever. There's an increasing body of economic research that points to the fact that the people you are interacting with are crucially important for the ideas and the creativity and the your own productivity, and this is reflected in wages, in patent creation, and in innovation in general. So, remarkably, in this increasingly globalized world, economic success is increasingly localized.
Is that why Walmart, which has its headquarters in Bentonville, Arkansas, not exactly a metropolis, decided to move their .com division to San Francisco?
Yeah, that's an interesting story. You know, nobody can accuse Walmart of making choices just to follow the latest trend. And yet, when they had to locate their Walmart.com, their internet division, they didn't pick Bentonville, which is one of the cheapest labor market in America and one of the cheapest real estate market in America. They picked Brisbane, 6 miles out of downtown San Francisco, one of the most expensive labor market in America and one of the most expensive real estate market in America. And the reason why they did it was that if you are in the innovation sector, you really need to be around other innovators. You cannot be isolated. Otherwise, you won't be as creative, and ultimately, you'll be losing your edge. So
also won't have as big a job pool out there, people who are skilled at what you want them to have skills in.
That's a crucial advantage that large innovation clusters have.
Now, in the past, that is the reason that New York was a major manufacturer of clothing. And there was a time during my lifetime when we were, I think, the largest in the world. No longer the case.
That's true.
And the theory at that time was they couldn't move away even though salaries were higher because you couldn't find people who were skilled enough. But they have found people who are skilled enough, not just in different parts of this country, but also in Malaysia and Korea and in Central America. So what's happened there?
Sure. Innovation clusters are, and manufacturing clusters are not forever. It is true, New York was one of the most important textile clusters in the world. Detroit used to be one of the most important car manufacturing clusters in the world. And both clusters have largely disappeared. But there are many other examples where clusters are able to reinvent themselves, New York being one, Silicon Valley being another one. And these stories teach us that what's really important from the point of view of a community is not necessarily what the identity of the employers in that community is, their ability to reinvent themselves when economic conditions change and to leverage their existing skill to create the next cluster. Now, what's a good job today will be a bad job tomorrow. And it's important that in this new economy, we are, as community, we're able to leverage our existing strengths to build solid foundation for the next phase.
But aren't some economists skeptical of the theory of knowledge spillover? Paul Krugman has said that it's impossible to account for how knowledge is passed around a community because it's invisible. So how much impact does spillover really have on productivity?
They do. When Paul Krugman made that comment, it was in the early 90s. And that comment spurred a lot of research. And over the past 20 years, we've seen a growing body of evidence that points to the fact that knowledge spillovers and knowledge externalities are increasingly important.
So is that enough of a reason for companies to resist outsourcing parts of their business?
I think so. In today's economy, if you are an high-tech company, your success depends more than just on the quality of your own worker. It depends on the entire ecosystem that surrounds it. So if you are a biotech company, it's really hard to delocalize in Vietnam because you'd have to move not just that company, you'd have to move the entire ecosystem. This stands in contrast, you know, if you're doing textile or toys, it's much easier. All you need to do is to find a place where there is cheap labor and good transportation. While in innovation, really, it's the entire ecosystem that matters, and that ecosystem is crucially important for the success of companies.
So aren't high-tech companies now just going to agglomerate in areas already with high concentrations of of similar industries like Silicon Valley, Boston, Seattle. New York hopes to be part of that.
That's what has been happening. If you look at the share of jobs in innovation or the share of R&D investment for the innovation hubs of America, it has been growing, not declining. And this is one of the key fundamental facts of our economy today. Stronger communities are becoming stronger and weaker communities are becoming weaker.
And does that mean that the mobility that we talked about in the past, where people would move to where the jobs are, is continuing?
The American workforce has always been extremely mobile, way more mobile than any other country. The average American changes address every 5 years, which is something that is unheard of for a European or even less for an Italian.
That's because many people have landlords like mine.
But what's often ignored is the fact that there are vast differences in mobility rate within the American labor force. College graduates tend to be very, very mobile. They're always on the move, always looking for better job opportunities somewhere. High school graduates are much less mobile, and high school dropouts are even less mobile. And this is actually, it's an important reason for the growing inequality that we see in the American labor market, because in a context where city economic fortunes are diverging over time, and you have cities that are getting stronger and stronger and other cities are getting weaker and weaker, mobility is a key mechanism through which American workers can take advantage of job opportunities somewhere else. And not all Americans are taking advantage of this to the same degree. Now, government policies are not helping either. If you look at the unemployment insurance system, for example, it provides no incentive for people to relocate to a better city. If you are in Flint and you're receiving an unemployment insurance check, you have no incentive to move to Austin or even Chicago, just nearby, because the amount of the check reflects the cost of living in Flint. But if you had to move to a stronger labor market, you'd be paying higher cost of living. So it's about time that we rethink the incentive system.
But I've always wondered why cities like Flint and Detroit suddenly go into those kinds of declines. After all, we're still manufacturing cars, and people knew how to manufacture them quite well. Was it government policies that led to the industries moving, in the case of automobiles, to other cities? Or was it simply a matter of companies trying to lower their labor costs by going to non-union places?
Well, it was a number of factors. Certainly, the rise of right-to-work laws certainly was very costly for Michigan. The management was very complacent, and state politicians ignored the threat from outside. But fundamentally, the reason why Detroit lost its cluster was an inability of reinventing itself after the car manufacturing started moving away. You see the same in other clusters. Take Rochester, New York, for example. Rochester, New York was one of the key innovation hubs of America in the 80s. But ever since Kodak started shedding jobs and being close to bankruptcy, it was never able to transform itself from an economy all centered on photographic equipment to a new economy. So these two cities, I think, represent exactly what not to do with a successful cluster. By contrast, you see cities like New York or Boston or San Francisco who have been able to reinvent themselves completely and to leverage their existing skill into something new.
So what can Silicon Valley learn from Detroit and Rochester? Because we know that in time, things are going to change again.
Of course. Economic research points to the fact that the rise of the innovation cluster in Silicon Valley tracks very, very closely the rise of Detroit as a manufacturing center in terms of population, jobs, wages, innovation. And so there's a lot that Silicon Valley could and should learn from Detroit. And the key things that they should learn is to adapt to new economic conditions. And in some sense, the Valley has been successful at that. The Valley was 70% focused on hardware until 15 years ago, and it has completely branched out into newer, most promising part of innovation, including software, internet, digital entertainment. So what's different between Silicon Valley and the Detroit story is that they both had a powerful, seemingly unassailable economic cluster at some point. But one wasn't able to move and to adapt. The other one has been moving and adapting constantly and remains on the edge of innovation.
Do local governments have to also be innovative to keep this thing going? I mean, could Detroit have done anything to have changed what happened?
It's a tall order. It's hard to see, if you look at the history of American manufacturing and innovation cluster, it's hard to see clusters that are engineered by local policies. It's really hard for a local government to help. What they can do is that they can try to make the economic climate as friendly as possible to the innovators.
To some degree, isn't it also the way people see themselves? You discovered that whether someone was making $20,000 a year or $300,000, they considered themselves members of the middle class.
Yeah, this is one of the most striking features of the American workforce, that I come from Italy, and in general, all European countries have a much stronger sense of economic class than you see here. And it, when I moved here...
And it was tied to politics often, and that
sure,
may be another reason.
Absolutely. But it's also refreshing to think... When I moved here, I find it very refreshing to find a country where class was not as big a deal as it is in Europe. At the same time, though, the economic workforce does have pretty deep and growing economic inequality. So it's although our perception of the American workforce as not really hard to define on a class basis remains, the reality is that there are growing differences, especially between those who have a good education and those who don't.
Well, the talk these days is about the 99% and the 1%. You say that that's not the best way to look at it.
Yes, I think there is too much talk about the difference between the millionaires and the billionaires on one hand and the rest of us. The big difference in over the past 30 years in the American labor market is the one between those who have a good education, those who have a college degree or an advanced degree, and those who don't. That's the difference between having a good, solid jobs that pays increasingly more, or having a precarious job that pays increasingly less. If you look at the average wage of work or of males, for example, in the U.S. over the past 30 years, an high school graduate has lost about 20% in wages relative to the previous generation. A college graduate has gained 30%, and someone with an high school with an advanced degree has gained even more.
And college grads have a lower unemployment rate.
They have lower unemployment rate. They have typically better non-salary compensation, meaning better pension and better health care. But the return to education are much broader than just the economic side. College graduates tend to also have tend to be healthier, tend to be more likely to be married and have been a stable relationship. Their children tend to be healthier and better educated. Education today is one of the key determinants of inequality in America. So that's why I'm saying inequality is not about the 1% versus the 99%. It's about the 25% of Americans with a college degree and the rest who don't.
We don't have much time left, but I saw a report this month from Rutgers University which reveals that 37% of students who graduated in the last 5 years wished they had been more careful in choosing their major. What fields should they have majored in? I mean, I was so bad at math, there's no way that I was going to wind up becoming an engineer.
Well, if you look at there are tremendous differences in starting salaries across majors. At the bottom, there are majors in the humanities and especially architecture, which is the one that pays the least. And at the top, there is engineering, math and stat, and increasingly economics. So I teach economics, and that's what the first thing I tell my students when they take my class is it's a good investment they're making in their future.
So we should all become economists. Like Enrico Moretti, his book, The New Geography of Jobs, Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.